Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. So we've got a wonderful programme ahead of us tonight. Can you hear that wonderful sound in the background there? Can you make out what it is? Sounds like birds, sounds like a bit of buzzing of bees. Could you combine them, do you think? Sounds to me like a bird called the bee eater. Well, several of them, a flock of them. Let's find out. Let's say hello to our panel now, starting with Richard Collins out in Malahide. Richard.
Hello, Derek. Nice to hear you and the bee eater.
And now to the land of medieval cities, alpine villages and Mediterranean beaches. It's known as the land of bread and cheese too. It's Niall Hatch in the south of France. Where exactly are you, Niall?
I'm in a place called Mondelou-la-Napoule, which is just to the west of Cannes, where my late father lived for many years. So I like to come down here sometimes and just sort of go do the things I used to do with him down here. It's a nice sort of trip down memory lane for me. And another trip down memory lane was that sound that you just played, mm-hmm. because I've been hearing that a lot. That is indeed the sound of beaters flying overhead. And migration is underway at the moment. And I was fortunate enough over the last few days actually to hear quite a few of those beaters flying over. And it's that sound that first draws the attention. So when you know that sound, you hear this chattering in the sky, you see these amazing birds flying over. And beaters, they are something else. They have the most incredible silhouette. They look a little bit like a swallow, I suppose, a bit bigger than that, but more sort of pointed wings. And rather than having a forked tail, they have a sort of very triangular tail with a sort of a long, like toothpick almost, that sticks out of the middle of it. So it's very unusual. But then also the colour of these birds. It's almost like you went to, I don't know, like a junior infant's school classroom and just asked them to colour in a bird any way they want. The most fantastic colours they can think of. Get all their crayons out, scribble all over the page. That's what a beater looks like. Chestnut brown on the head, a bit of chestnut in the wings, the flash of green, lemon yellow on the throat, turquoise blue down on the belly. Just an incredible looking creature.
It's arguable that the bee eater, our European bee eater, is the most varied coloured bird in the Western Palearctic. It is enormously variable in colour. It has every possible colour under the sun in its plumage. Now, just why it is like that is something of a mystery. Now, it feeds on things like bees. It loves bees, ants, insects that produce poison. Perhaps, what do you think, Niall? Is it that the flesh is distasteful? If the bird is eating these awful poisonous things, does it result in distasteful flesh, which deters predators? Once bitten, twice shy, a predator may not attack a bee eater twice. What do you think?
Well, that's certainly a very interesting theory. It's certainly worth investigating, because certainly bright colours like that in nature, they tend to act as warning signals. If you think of the yellow and black on a bee or on a wasp, ironically the favourite food of the bee eater, that warns off most predators. They won't make that mistake twice. Now, the bee eaters, they have a special biology that allows them to eat that prey, but even then they remove the sting. So whether they're ingesting much of that poison themselves, I'm not sure. What they do is they fly out. They're very adept and very aerobatic. They would grab the insect and take it back in their beaks, and then they often would rub the stinger on a branch or on a stone to break it off, and then they consume the insect. So whether they're getting the poison into their systems, I don't know. They are related to the hoopoe, another flamboyant looking bird, black and white butterfly like wings, a pink body with this crest it raises and lowers on the head, and that is a bird we know is distasteful to predators. Its flesh tastes very, very bad. It's actually mentioned in the book of Leviticus in the Bible as being something that isn't kosher, something that that should not be eaten because it was presumably thought to be maybe poisonous because it tastes and smells so bad. Maybe the bee eater is the same, I'm not sure. Now, there are quite a few different species of bee eaters around the world, particularly the old world. You don't find them in the Americas. You do find them throughout Africa, Asia and Australia. And the situation here, as you said there, Richard, you called it the European bee eater, and it is the only bee eater that occurs across most of Europe. We don't have them in Ireland except as very very rare vagrants. They do turn up very occasionally. Sometimes they can be seen perched on wires. I've never seen one in Ireland myself, I have to say, but some lucky bird watchers have. But we do know that their range has been creeping northwards in Europe over the last few years, to the extent that they've actually bred in recently in southern England. They're a species that nests in similar sort of places to the sand martin, a member of the swallow family, that excavates tunnels, particularly in sandbanks and in old gravel quarries. And the bee eater is associated with these gravel quarries as well. So as the climate changes, and if that continues apace, as it seems unfortunately inevitably will, maybe the bee eater is a bird that could make landfall in Ireland, and then all of a sudden our bees and our wasps will have a new predator to contend with that they've never had to deal with before.
Niall, that's an interesting thing that you should mention. The roller, it's a much larger bird, is also a relative, and rollers sometimes eat snakes. So this penchant for eating poisonous things is part of the larger group to which this bird belongs. But there is something interesting as well. It is the structural coloration. If we take most of our birds, it's pigment added to the white feather that produces color. But in things like bee-eaters and kingfishers and rollers, it's the actual crystalline structure of the feather that gives the colors. An interesting thing about that is that the color changes depending on the angle of the light. So as you will find that some things look red when you look at them front on, and they look blue or green or yellow when you look at them from the side. So this seems to be some kind of trick they are using to change colour, to sort of make themselves invisible or hard to find, perhaps. But it is very interesting that these birds go to the trouble of producing structural coloration.
Yes, I suppose the most familiar or maybe celebrated example of that structural coloration would be in the hummingbirds, those wonderful iridescent colors that they produce, different shades of green predominantly, but also reds and blues and purples. It's absolutely astonishing how they look. With the bee eater, they don't quite glint in the same way as that, but it is structural color nonetheless. In fact, when you see blue in a bird, that's usually the case, and often green as well. The head of a mallard, the familiar duck, the male mallard at least, that bright green, that is also structural coloration. And the interesting thing about that is that when you get those feathers, if you were to get one in experimental conditions, hopefully not still attached to the bird, and to bash it really hard with a hammer, you can actually disrupt the reflective surfaces or refractive surfaces in the microstructures in the feather, and then the feather will just go grey or black. The colour just disappears. It's not pigmentation. Or what can happen, and this is the case in the bee eater and some other species as well, you get a combination of pigmentation and structural coloration bouncing back all sorts of different wavelengths of light that make other colours again. It's far more fantastical than you can even imagine with paint, because that's just pigmentation. And that's one of the reasons why when you see pictures of birds like bee eaters, or maybe a bird like a kingfisher, maybe one that would be more familiar to people at home, and a species that is related, they're in the same sort of general group with the hoopoes and the rollers and so on, a photograph to my eyes never quite captures what those birds really look like. It can get close, but it never quite captures that spark, that glint, that almost that electricity that runs through their feathers. And the bee eater, I think, is a classic example of that.
And we'll make sure that we have a picture of a bee eater on the website now, just so everybody can get a look at one. Now, we're playing another sound for you now. Any idea what this is? Sounds a bit like rushing water, but actually it is thousands upon thousands of bats flying overhead. Can you just picture that scene? Well, if you live in Texas, there's a place called Bracken Cave where during the summer months, literally millions of bats emerge from that cave there. It's a huge tourist attraction. Has been described as a tornado of bats. I'd love to go and see it someday. Anyway, why am I telling you this? Well, between Britain and Ireland, we have some 14 species of bat and in excess, as I understand it, of 2,500 species of moth. Which is great for the bats, considering they like to dine al fresco. But do they always get the meal? Well, recently, scientists at the University of Bristol have discovered that the ermine moth has evolved a very special acoustic defence mechanism against their echolocating predators, bats. To tell us more about it, we're joined now by Mark Holder Reed, Professor of Sensory Biology at the School of Biological Sciences. Mark joins us now from his home in Bristol. Hello, Mark. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks, Derrit. And hi, Niall, and hi, Richard.
So, Mark, you're a big fan of moths. You think they're amazing. Why?
I think moths are the most amazing creatures because they have such amazing acoustics. So by acoustics, I mean everything they do with sound, and that specifically how they respond to bats who use sound with their echolocation to find them. And there is this age-long, multi-million years long arms race that's raging every night over our heads. And there are many attack strategies that the bats use and counter adaptations that the moths have evolved, which is a stunning arms race. And that's what I study. I want to understand how a moth avoids being bats' next meal and how they're being very smart about it.
Well, the first thing that surprises me is the fact that you're saying that moths use sound as a defense mechanism. I always thought of them as being silent.
So some of the moths turn the sound game around. So bats use sound and sonify them, and some bats just call back, and they call back to startle an attacking bat, or maybe confuse its biosonar. The jury's a bit out on that still. So yes, they produce very loud, very confusing sounds, and that confuses the bat enough to give the moth an edge so it can fly away.
So let's explain exactly how a bat focuses in, hones in on its prey.
Let's assume that we are all hungry little bats and we are out there in the complete darkness and we're on the hunt for this nice, juicy little moth that's out there too. So what I do is I produce sound, but I produce a very high-pitched sound, and I do this with a voice box, very much like we humans or other mammals do. They just have a modified voice box so they can produce higher frequencies. And then that sound is just propagated out into the night. And if there's nothing out there, then that's it. The bat won't hear anything. But if it hits an insect, it reflects the sound back and it comes back to the bat as an echo. And it's that echo that gives away the presence of this nice little juicy moth. And then the bat would get closer and closer using more and more echoes. And in the end, it is good enough to grab it and catch it and eat it.
Now, is it getting that reflection, that echo through its ears?
So bats being just standard mammals like me are, well, not super standard. They can fly and they can echolocate, but by all respects, they're just mammals. They haven't reinvented the wheel with hearing. They're just using the same hearing apparatus that we have, just modified. They can hear higher frequencies, but other than that, it's the same stuff that we do.
And there are lots of moths out there at nighttime. Anybody who's ever set up a moth trap or has been out at nighttime with a light will tell you that there's big ones, the small ones, there are all sorts. Do bats, because I think we've 9 species of bat here in Ireland, do they all hunt for the same prey? Do they know the difference between one moth and another moth?
That's a very good, intriguing question, actually. I think they do. And the way they do this is a large moth has more surface, bigger wings to create echoes, so they have louder echoes. So a bat that flies around can probably work out how loud an echo is and get a fairly good idea how big the moth is that is out there. Whether it can discriminate between 2 similar-sized moths, I doubt that. I think that their sonar imaging is very coarse. It doesn't have the high resolution that our vision has. So they probably just know there is something out there. They might not even be aware that it's a moth, just a flying insect, and attack that anyway.
So what you're saying is they're not fussy eaters. So long as they get a meal, they're happy enough. Now, I want you to talk to me about the ermine moth, which I mentioned in the introduction, and another moth you've been doing research on, which is the tiger moth.
So there are 2 amazing stories that we've recently looked into. And the first one is moths that produce sound. So a bat attacks, and then these moths send signals, sound signals, back towards the bat. And that either confuses it, or in this case, because this is a toxic moth, in this case, it's a warning signal. So the first time the bat would still eat it, but it would then dislike the taste. And next time it hears that same sound, it would never, ever attack it again. So it's a bit like the acoustic equivalent of the black and yellow striping of bees and hoverflies that act as a warning signal. So what we found is that these moths, and we're talking about ermine moths, they are very common pests on orchards, so not very welcome in our gardens. But these moths, they produce these warning sounds, whenever they're flying. And we discovered this weird thing where they flex their wing, and in the wing they have a buckling structure, a little bit like when you have an empty water bottle and you sort of twist it and it cracks as you do. That's a buckling motion. And they do this with every wing stroke, and that produces these warning sounds. We call it an aeroelastic timbre, something that produces sound as the wing deforms during the wing stroke.
And this is deliberate on behalf of the moth. It's telling the bat that you don't like the taste of me.
Exactly. So whenever they fly, they send that signal. What I find intriguing, that this moth is completely deaf. So it isn't even aware that it's producing sound. But this is what evolution does, right? It equips this moth, this organism, with a defense without the organism being aware that it's using it. But it works.
It works, Mark. Come on, come on. Now, how do you know, first of all, that the moth is deaf? That's the first thing I want to know. And the second thing is, how do you know it's making the sound? Have you recorded the moth actually producing the sound?
So the first answer is, so how do you know whether a moth is deaf or not? So you let it fly and then you send ultrasound at it. And if it can hear, it will fly away. The other thing is, you just look all over the body and look for ears. And well, we've discovered, well, we scientists have discovered quite a few different ears on insects over the years. So we know what to look for. These ermine moths, they just don't have any ears, and they don't have the behavior either. They never respond to sound. So that was the first one. And how do we know that they produce sound? So when you're out on a bat walk, your guide probably will bring along something called a bat detector. So that's a microphone that is sensitive at frequencies we can't hear, and then that translates it down to the frequency range that we can hear, and that we then can hear the bats foraging around us. But sometimes one of these moths flies past, and then you hear in the bat detector these very different noises, these warning noises that the moth produces. And this is how it was discovered. You just used the bat detector and noticed, okay, there's something weird there. Look, have a closer look, and then, yeah, you find out that there is interesting sound production going on.
And you've actually sent me the recording of an ermine moth in flight. So close your eyes. It's pitch dark, and all you hear is this sound flying towards you, if you could hear it. And you'd be wondering, what's that? Well, we now know it's a moth. That's absolutely incredible. But it leads me on to my next question. Did you actually see a bat spit out one of these moths? Or did you witness a bat making a beeline for a moth, and at the last minute, once it realises, that's not the one I want to taste, you taste awful, abort the mission?
We've tried a few things there. The first thing I should say, bats are protected species, so I can't just feed them a toxic moth. That would have been the first thing I would have tried, but I'm not allowed. That's absolutely not possible. The same species of moth was fed to birds in a study from some time ago, and they went really unwell after ingesting these moths. And we know the toxic compounds they have. And I should say that one of my students froze one of these moths and just licked it. And it's a very, very bitter experience. So we are pretty convinced that if we can feel that it's bitter, birds can do that, then the bats will experience something similar.
But I'm still curious to know how close a bat will get before it realises this one is off the menu.
So if a bat is out there and it uses its echolocation, there is this one point at which the danger starts, and that's the distance that the bat has to have from this moth when the bat first detects the echo. If it's further away, the bat would simply be unaware and might fly past. But so the first stage is get close enough by chance, and that's what the bat does. And at the moment that it enters into this I can hear your echo zone, it also hears the warning sound. So that's finely tuned. So these warning sounds have just the right amplitude to kick in at the moment that the bat might initiate an attack. And an experienced bat would then hear this warning sound immediately and abandon the attack, not even get any closer. So I think it's a very finely tuned and effective defence.
It's extraordinary. Richard Collins.
Mark, that is fascinating. I'm just looking at it from the point of view of the bat. Now, it is expensive sending out pulses, so the bat normally is sent out what for a bat is a relatively slow train of pulses. And then when it finds something to attack, It moves in, and as it moves in, the frequency at which the pulses go out increases. So you're getting a lot of pulses as it homes in. It needs this if it's to clearly see, and in inverted commas, see its prey. Is this like two fighter planes, one locking on to the other? Is there a kind of a lock-on point when the moth detects, oh, I'm going to be attacked by this beastie, I'm now going to send off my warning shots or my blocking interference to deter this animal from coming any closer? Or does it just fly around and put out these sounds all the time?
So what you're describing is absolutely right. So what you just described is what we call a feeding buzz, because that's what it sounds like in a pet detector. It's like normal echolocation would be and then they do a buzz, and then it's and that's when they try and grab an insect. And you're right, they increase their calling rate. And that is because they get closer, so they don't have to wait that long for the moth's echo to come back. And this is why they can produce calls at a higher rate. Now, the species we've just discussed, the ermine moth, it's completely deaf to its own calls, but it's also completely deaf to the bat's calls. So it's unaware whether bats are around or not. And because it doesn't know, it has to send this warning signal all the time. And the beauty of it is that because it's linked to their flight, to their wings, it is sending that signal all the time. So this is the story of the ermine moth. But what you've mentioned earlier is a strategy that is used by a range of other moths, particularly tiger moths. They have ears and they also can produce sounds. By the way, these sounds sound remarkably similar to the sound of the ermine moth. We believe that they are mimicking each other acoustically, very much like wasps and hoverflies mimic each other visually. So, and then these tiger moths, when they are attacked, they wait until the bat is close, dangerously close, and then they blast it with a sound. And that could be a warning, but a very cost-efficient warning, because you only produce sound when it's absolutely needed, not all the time. Or it could be this confusing, startling sound. So a bat approaches, it's ready to hear this next echo, and instead it hears a really loud, blasting sound coming off this moth, which it didn't expect and can't process, and that gives the moth an edge.
But isn't that a giveaway to the bat? If this sound is coming out, I have prey if I only can catch it. Now, it seems to me odd that bats, after 65 million years, they are able to discriminate very well their own pulses from the myriad of pulses that are coming from all the other bats that are feeding with it. It has excellent discrimination. Surely it has evolved a way to find the echoes coming back despite the jamming, or is that fanciful?
I agree. After 65 million years, they should have found a way to break through. But don't forget, the moths have been around for equally long. So they've had the same amount of time to optimize their signals such that they still confuse a bat. And I think this is a defense that actually works. And the bat has yet to find a way to break through that defense.
Now, it's the bat's signal, or pulses rather, that triggered this reaction. It is nothing to do with the moth in a sense. It has these devices worked into the wing which shoot out with all this noise whenever the bat's signal hits it. Is this the sort of model? Is that the way? So how does that actually work? This is an extraordinary thing. It is responding to a sound from outside and sending out this blast. And that must require a lot of energy. It should try and minimize that from the point of view of survival. Is that what happens?
Absolutely right. Cost is very important. So if you can get your defense for cheaper, you should do it. And producing less sound sounds like something that is cheaper. Let me clarify one thing. So we've got two different moth species here. We've got the ermines, and they produce sound whenever they're flying, and they're deaf. So they're not responding to a bat. They're just, whenever they take flight, they switch on their defense. It's like a siren that they put on and warn everybody, even if nobody is there to hear it. And then you've got the tiger moth, who produce very similar sounds. Plus, they have ears, and they respond to the attack of a bat and only blast out sound when a bat is close enough for the sound to have maximum effect.
Mark, it's fascinating to hear you talk about moths and just how adept they are at survival, thanks to the wonders of evolution. I think they're a really underappreciated group of animals. And the ermine moth that you mentioned, it's actually one of my favourites because I think it's a really pretty creature. I've seen them many times, and a lot of people think of moths as being very drab, mixtures of browns and greys and so on. The ermine moth is this beautiful snow-white creature with little flecks of black on it, like you would see on the ermine fur that would line the robe of a monarch, something like that. The black being the tips of the stoat's tail or the ermine's tail. So I never knew that they didn't have ears, though, and that they weren't capable of hearing. But I did have the amazing experience of actually witnessing that myself once when I was on a bat walk in Wales. We were out with the bat detector and we could hear bats flying overhead and then heard this clicking and looked down and saw that it was actually a moth. It took us a while to track it down. And what was interesting is that it wasn't an ermine moth, and I don't think it was a tiger moth either. So I'm wondering if there's other species that do this.
So, awesome experience, by the way. I would have loved to see what you've got there. So, we are only starting to understand how many moths are producing sound. So, the story with the ermine that we talked about, we've discovered that this kind of sound production in the wing has evolved several times, maybe 10 times independently in moths. And I am aware that there are several species in the UK that produce sounds by flapping their wings, but we have never recorded them. And what you have seen there might very well have been one of them. So this is a call to all the moth and bat enthusiasts out there. Take a bat detector next to your light trap. If you see anything that produces sound, catch it and send me a picture, or ideally make a recording and send those to me. I'd love to hear from you.
Mark, I was really impressed by the story you said there about the research student who went so far as to actually lick a moth to see if it tasted bitter. I was just thinking, we have to do that in the program, Derek.
No!
You have to do a taste test in the studio, no?
No, I ate pig's ear once. That was enough.
But I was really intrigued when you were saying there about the mimicry as well, about how the tiger moths are imitating the signal that the ermine moths are sending, and how they only do it when the bats are actually close by. Do they emerge from the chrysalis being innately able to do that, or is it a sound that they have to learn from listening to ermine moths? Are moths capable of learning even?
I think that's a good question. I think moths probably can learn where to find nectar, and they learn preferences for flowers. The sound production, I think this is an innate mechanism and ability. They just have the wiring, they have the equipment, and whenever the opportunity or the need is there, it will just be triggered and the sound is produced. I don't think there is learning involved on that front. But I'm pretty sure that moths have a limited ability to learn things like visual stimuli, find their way around, maybe be able to home back to the bush where they were born and lay eggs there. But very hard to study this. I've got a colleague who studies the brains of butterflies, and they do some remarkable things with learning indeed.
Oh my goodness, the brain of a butterfly. I mean, you're wrecking my own head now. How small must it be?
Well, it needs to fit in a butterfly's head, so you can get a fairly good idea.
What's the purpose of all this research? What can you do with it? You've got all this information now. You've found out something. Now what?
Okay, good. So I think this study here, that's a nice camouflage and acoustic arms race story. I love it. It's good for natural history stories. But I've got other aspects of this bat moth's arms race that I believe can really give something back to us as humans and make us live healthier and, in particular, quieter lives. So that story starts with, again, echolocation and bats. Now, if a moth is flying and it can't produce sound and it can't hear a bat because it's deaf and it doesn't have any sound production, how can it defend itself? How can it improve its chances of surviving an encounter with an echolocating bat? And there we discovered something remarkable. So these moths, as we all know, they're covered in these scales and the fine dust that comes off when you touch a moth or a butterfly. These are tiny bits of chitin that cover the whole body. Now, what we discovered is that this layer, it's only a fraction of a millimeter thick. This layer is a very powerful sound absorber, and it absorbs all the sounds that the bats send out to create these echoes. And what that means is when a sound hits this flying moth, rather than reflecting the sound back to the bat and giving away the presence of the moth, that echo or that sound reflection is much reduced. In an ideal case, it absorbs everything. But it's not that good, but it reduces the echo substantially, thereby shrinking the distance over which echolocation works in detecting it. So a bat needs to get much closer just because it's wrapped in this what we call a stealth cloak against detection by biosonar. And that's a really fascinating discovery we made a few years ago. The technology behind it is something very exotic as well. So we've got some emergent properties there with many different scales resonating and wobbling, each tuned to its own frequency. Mm-hmm. And together they absorb all the frequencies. Now, how does this help us? It's fascinating, but how can we profit from this? Now, what we found out when we investigated this is that these sound-absorbing scales on the moth are actually 10 times better at absorbing sound than any sound absorbers we currently use, for example, in our living rooms or in your recording studio. And that means if we understand how the moth does it, we could build better, thinner, lighter, maybe cheaper sound absorber solutions. And for the last years, we have focused our efforts onto understanding how the moth does it. And we've cracked it. We now know exactly the mechanism by which that sound is absorbed. We can replicate it. We have translated it down to the frequencies that we care about. So our much lower frequencies that we use for speaking, particularly that our neighbors use for speaking and the road noise has. And we can now produce and build much thinner sound absorbers. And in my mind, I have this vision that we can create something that I like to call acoustic wallpaper. So something that's very thin and is still a sound absorber. And it's so thin and convenient that people would happily invite it into their homes and make their own life quieter and therefore healthier.
And tell me, have you already produced a roll of wallpaper and pasted it on the wall, and does it work?
So we've got prototypes. We've just this summer we've built our first batch of many square meters, and later this month we go up to Salford to an acoustic testing facility, which is an acoustic room, and we can then quantify the acoustic performance of it. We've got our own little performance measurement device here, and we know that it works, and we know that we can tune it. So yes, we've got it. Actually, a year ago, we submitted a patent, so we are ready to plow ahead and see whether we can get this out and give the people the opportunity to have a quieter life.
I'm just thinking your student who was licking the ermine moth, and my mind has gone back to Willy Wonka. Didn't he have some kind of wallpaper that you could lick and you got the taste of all sorts of goodies, Niall? Do you remember Willy Wonka's chocolate factory?
I absolutely do, from the film. Quite a bizarre film. And he did, they had lickable wallpapers in the book as well, the Roald Dahl book. I think this is amazing. This collaboration, I can see, Mark, with the University of Bristol, there's going to be this huge research now into lickable moth soundproof wallpaper. Well, it's going to be amazing.
Let's see. It's a journey. I'm not an entrepreneur. My calling is in research, so finding and discovering these things. So if we can do something good and give it back, that's enough reward for me.
But what will you call it? If you do develop this wallpaper, what will you actually call it?
Ah,
you must have thought about it.
So we have thought about a name for our product, and that is, we've named it in the honor of the largest moth that we have on the planet, and that's the Atlas moth. And the Atlas, the scientific name of the Atlas moth is Attacus, and that's what we call it, Attacus.
Well, I look forward to hanging it on my wall someday, Mark. Thank you.
Oh, that would be awesome.
It would be awesome. Mark, thank you very much indeed.
Yeah. Anytime. It was a pleasure. I enjoyed this. Thank you, Derek, so much. Thank you for having me. And Niall and Richard, lovely talking to you.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Mark. It was great. Really enjoyed it.
We will talk to you again. Now, let's say hello to Terry Flanagan, who I believe was on a trip down memory lane. Terence, tell me more.
Yes, Derek, I was indeed. I was up in County Monaghan, and it brings back memories to me because my mother was from County Monaghan. Although, whenever I ask people the townland that she was from when I'm up there, she was from a little townland called Bonn. And I ask people, did you ever hear of this townland called Bonn? And they all say, no, I never heard of it. So I don't know whether my mother came from Monaghan or not. But anyway, I was up there, and I was up visiting a farmer, and he was no ordinary farmer. Kieran Corley farms snails.
Escargot.
Yes, snails, and he's more than a million of them. And a few years ago, he noticed a market for escargot on the continent, and he started to farm them. But then an interesting thing happened.
Oh, yeah.
Because he was constantly handling the snails, his arms were continually exposed to snail slime or mucilage. Mm. And the scars and the dermatitis in his arms suddenly cleared up.
I see.
He decided to investigate and discovered the power of healing of this mucilage. And he set up a company to take advantage of this snail slime. And that's not all. Snails are monogamous. But Kieran noticed that they don't all find a mate during the season. So he's developed a way of helping them find love. He collects all the singletons and transfers them to a special love den where they all meet the snail of their dreams. So to find out more about these amorous snails and the magical substances in their slime, I recently travelled north to Drumlin County to meet him.
All right, Terry, first of all, can I welcome you to Scotstown in County Monaghan? And I want to take you in here and show you some of the snails in the snail house.
This is your snail house. It looks to me like a tunnel. I've never seen anything like it before because there are rows and rows and rows of, I don't know how to describe them, but it's like netting with wooden frames on the top of it. And the other thing is, I can see very few snails. How many snails are in this house?
So there's approximately a million in this house, okay, and we do a roll call every day, okay. It takes a long time, but we get it done. But let me show you. So underneath these feeding boards, those timber things you're referring at the top of the beds or top of the are the snails. And because they're nocturnal, you won't really see them during the day.
But okay, so you've just turned over one of these boards here. The board is probably a meter long by probably 20 centimeters wide, and underneath it there's 50-100 snails. Beautiful looking snails, actually.
Oh, but they look like their owner, Terry. Come on.
No, but they are. They're very, very healthy looking. And they all seem to be the same species, are they?
Yeah. So actually, we do have, what you're looking at here is a single species, but we do have two species. We have an Alexa Muller, which is the same one that crawls across your doorstep in the morning after a heavy shower rain. Or we have an Alexa Maxima, and we use the Alexa Maxima because it's a bigger snail and hence we get more mucin from a bigger snail.
The reason why you started with snails was to provide food, escargot, is that right?
Back 2018, early 2019, I started to farm snails purely for food because the world market is undersupplied with snails for human consumption. Okay, and particularly in Asia now, and the Chinese, they've come to develop a little bit of a graph for the old snail. So the world market is expanding for actual snails for eating. Okay, we all think of France, but actually there's more snails eaten in Spain or Italy than there is in France. And because of the weather climate changes that have come along in the last 20 years, their climate is no longer suited, really. I mean, they've lost a lot of the humidity in their climate. Unfortunately for us, or fortunately, whichever way you want to look at it, Ireland has still got plenty of humidity in the air. And these guys love humidity. That's what they live for.
But you then diversified, is that correct?
Yeah. So after working with the snails for about 3 months, and in those 3 months we bought Irish snails from County Carlow, we bought 50,000 breeder snails. And after working with those 50,000 snails for 3 months, I noticed some things that had happened to my own skin and my own arms. So I've 50 years of living in these arms, and I carry with it the scars of 70 years of living, probably. Mm. But after a period of 3 months, I noticed that these scars were all clearing, to the point that they're almost invisible at this stage. Then came lockdown, and I started investigating what's going on. The only thing I was doing different was farming snails. So I started to investigate why my skin had miraculously recovered, and I discovered that the little snail was wholly responsible for it.
Because as you were handling the snails, this mucin or mucilage was covering your skin.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So snail mucin, when it's chemically analysed, is full of all of the good things that you can put on your skin. Collagen, allantoin, glycolic acid, retinol, hyaluronic acid. Mm. Those things are all naturally occurring in snail slime. And in fact, my grandmother used to tell me stories about working in the field. And if someone got injured, you know, bad cut or something, the kids would all be sent to gather snails. And when they gathered those snails, they'd place the snails on the area of the cut, and the snail mucin would be used as stitching because it's antibacterial, it's antimicrobial, and anti-inflammatory. So I didn't invent it. My granny knew about it before I did. And 2,500 years ago, Hippocrates, he was using snails to cure people with skin allergies or skin ailments.
So you have decided then to turn your business from growing snails for food to growing snails for their mucin.
Absolutely. After I discovered what this could do, I found a few guinea pigs, or sort of friends and family, created our own product and started testing this snail mucin on other people's skin, and quickly discovered that it possesses huge potential for healing damaged skin cells. So very quickly I decided, okay, we'll forget about eating them and maybe we'll get the snail mucin from them instead.
Right. Now, you also allow them to reproduce here. They have an incredible reproductive cycle. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, okay, so snails are incredible when it comes to reproduction. They are hermaphrodites, which means they have both male and female sexual organs, but they do need a partner. They always need a partner to mate. They're also monogamous, so they have to find that special one. So each of the beds I have here in the farm has between 100 and 130,000 snails in it. And there are occasions when quite a few of those maybe don't meet their perfect partner. When they do, after 24 hours of getting to know one another, they will do the business and then they will each lay potentially 100 eggs.
Most people, when they hear about the reproduction of snails, they think of these love darts.
Yeah, so snail mating is a bit like Russian roulette. Okay, somebody's going to die, unfortunately, Terry. Someone's going to die. So when two snails mate, they fire a dart at each other. And this is the origin of Cupid's arrow. So this dart is laced with enzymes that will arouse the partner or the intended partner. Now, when you scale it up, if it were two humans firing darts, they would be 12 inches long. So it can actually do a lot of damage to the intended partner. But let's just say they get over that. After they have then exchanged semen, each snail will secrete an enzyme to kill the semen of the other snail. Because in this world, nobody wants to be a pregnant snail. Watch out there, people. Just make sure you're not a pregnant snail.
And why is that?
Okay, so the snail will carry her eggs immediately underneath the shell for about 15 days. And during that time, she will nourish them and she will look after them and she will help them along. But as those eggs grow, they're effectively pushing the mommy snail out of the shell. So much so that at the end of the process, the very last thing that the mother will do is lay her eggs, and then she unfortunately will pass away. But she's left the world with 100 potential babies in her wake, and she's actually given her life for them to have a chance.
Snails, they're not blind, but they only see in black and white.
Yeah, very poor eyesight. They can just about tell the difference between day and night, but they actually have a fantastic smell. Like big cats in the wild in Africa or wherever else that David Attenborough might be, they can actually smell other snail slime trails, and they can tell a lot from the other snail just from smell, whether that snail is ready for mating or whether it's not matured yet or whether it's just not suited to them. So, yeah, very poor eyesight, no hearing whatsoever, but very good smell.
But not all of the snails, going back to the reproductive cycle, not all of them find a partner, as you well know. So you've done something special.
Yeah, we like to give the snails a second chance in life. So as this season comes to an end, I will take all of the mature snails that are in 7 beds and put all of them into one single bed, which I call the Lonely Hearts bed.
It's a bit like a disco, is it?
It's a bit like speed dating, I would say. Only it's not very speedy, as you can imagine, these are snails. But anyway, so in this last bed, they all have the chance to visit each other and see if they can find the special one in that particular bed. And I have proof of the pudding because I have lots of babies in that bed.
Okay, we can have a look at that bed now. If we just walk down to here, because this is it, you show me. This is a special bed, bed number 8. So let's have a look then to see where these babies are.
Okay, so when I turn the boards, okay, you'll see that the majority of them are mature snails and big, okay? Yeah. And that's because they have arrived into this bed from other beds. But here you can
see a couple of them there,
smaller babies.
Tiny little ones, absolutely tiny.
Pinpricks,
yeah. So they wouldn't have had a chance at life except for your help.
Correct. I'm thinking about heading down to Listenvarna now next month and maybe help a few humans. But no. Yeah, so these babies are as a result of me taking all of the Lonely Hearts and putting them in the one, and they have found love in that single bed and recreated.
Now, there's one guy here, and he's on his own. I don't know why. And he's got an unusual neck on him, so to speak. This guy over here. Kieran, explain to me about him.
This guy is heavily pregnant.
There's a black band or something just at the tip of the shell.
That's his egg sac. So it's actually bulging out from underneath the shell. That means this guy is ready to lay his eggs somewhere on the ground. He might even go down there tonight, burrow into the ground and lay up to 100 eggs.
Now you say this guy, he's neither a guy nor a gal. He's both, isn't he?
He is both, but it's very confusing if you're talking about them every day. So I refer to them all as guys, but no, they are hermaphrodites. They have both male and female sexual organs, so they're neither male nor female.
Now, he will probably go down, as you say, tonight. He'll go down into the soil here, because I'm looking at the ground. You have plants here, you see, you have common, what we might call weeds. I see a lot of nettles and that here. Is there any reason, or do you plant special plants here within the beds?
Yeah, actually we have a combination, and yeah, those are nettles. But snails love nettles because nettles are high in calcium, which helps them to keep a strong and healthy shell. Yeah. But the others are special plants that we bring in from Greece, a lot of them, and we plant them so that the snails have a vegetation to eat. But we also supplement that with this meal at the top, where you can see that's specially formulated from dried fruit and dried vegetables, and the snails just love it. In fact, a snail will multiply its birth weight by 1,000 from it is laid, when that egg is laid, to when it's fully mature, when it's going to weigh approximately 12, 13 grams.
Do you have problems then with predators or parasites?
Yeah. In the wild, approximately 3% of snails will mature. And that's because of natural predators. And it's also because sometimes they're just lazy little buggers. But so in this snail house that you're standing in, you can see that we have a netting across the top to make sure that the birds can't get in, because these would be almost like chicken nuggets for the birds. Mm-hmm. And along the bottom, we have steel girders which keep out mice and vermin or rats or anything else that would like to crawl in. So those actually go down into the ground about 500 mil, and they come up above the ground about 500 mil. So that's to give these guys the best opportunity. I also give them a shower of rain, which is actually a sprinkler system, but I give them a shower of rain each night at dusk, just as darkness is falling.
Because they are nocturnal animals.
Absolutely.
Does that encourage them then to come out?
It does indeed, yeah. So ideally they would like a shower of rain just as it's getting dark. That encourages them to pop their head out to see what conditions are like. They have an excellent sense of smell, so I have food everywhere in the snail house. So if I convince them to pop their head out and consider coming out, and they get a smell of the food, well, they're up on the feeding board straight away.
Now, tell us how you collect the mucin.
A snail will secrete slime for three reasons. The first reason is for them to move without friction. But this tells us something in itself. Because snails are travelling across bacteria-ridden surfaces, and that snail slime has to be antibacterial. So it's naturally antibacterial. So that's the first thing. Second thing is a little snail will secrete a little slime if he wants to stick. So you can see here in the snail house where all these guys are underneath these feeding boards, and they're sort of gone to sleep for the day. But they've secreted slime, and that makes them that can stick to the underside of the board. Mm-hmm. The third reason that a snail will secrete slime is to heal itself. If it damages its foot or its shell, it will secrete slime to that area to repair it. And that's the healing bit that I'm trying to grab in the products. Mm-hmm. Now, when I want to take mucin from these guys, I hire in a special machine. Okay? And that machine has a glass dome. Okay? It's filled full of steam and it's very moist and warm in there. And then we gently rock the floor back and forth. So the little snail thinks, well, I'm moving here and I don't want to move. And in his mind, he sort of says, well, okay, how do I stop moving? I secrete slime. And that I can make me stick, so I won't have to move. But when he secretes the slime, because the floor is a mesh, it's a stainless steel mesh, and the mucin, therefore, flows down underneath, and we collect it underneath that floor.
And how much slime would you get from a single snail? Or can you quantify
it? I haven't really quantified it like that, but what we would say is that you will get a litre of snail mucin from 20,000 snails over the course of a season, but that's three harvests. You can harvest slime, give them a month off, harvest slime, give them a month off, harvest slime, give them a month off in the course of a season. And for 20,000 snails, you'll collect a litre of snail mucin.
And it doesn't affect the snail in any way?
No.
It's like giving blood.
Very similar. So, I mean, if a snail, and a snail will move on average 27 metres in a day, okay, which is more than a lot of humans I know.
Right.
But if a snail moves 27 metres, it will secrete enough slime to cover that 27 metres. But if he decides to move one, well, he'll only secrete. So, you know, we're just asking him to secrete slime to have him to stop or stick. It doesn't harm him in any sense. And then he goes back to the pasture.
So, tell us a little bit then about the business. How is it going?
Okay, so we started with local guinea pigs, friends, relations, and we started using snail slime and aloe vera, which we made on the kitchen table, to treat people's psoriasis or eczema or dermatitis, those types of issues. And very quickly, we had a reputation out there for having a product that worked. So people started calling to the house. I would open the front door and they would say, "Are you the snail man? We want to talk to the snail man." I, after a while, sort of could say nothing, but yeah, I suppose I am the snail man. And then they would say, "Well, we want some of that snail stuff." So very quickly, by word of mouth, the success that we were having in treating skin ailments grew, and I decided, look, we better make this official, we better get this product formally registered and all of that good stuff. So we worked with a company in Italy to create these products. They're all stamped and certified and registered with Europe. And we've been selling products from 2022, and I have a very proud record where about 85% of people who buy from us come back.
That is incredible. You know, I would never have thought of it, that you could harvest snails to take the mucin from them to use as a product that would cure the likes of eczema and dermatitis.
Yeah, and I'd love, Terry, to be able to claim that I created this, but about 2,500 years ago, a guy called Hippocrates, he is responsible for the Hippocratic Oath, and he was using snails and snail slime to cure people with skin ailments, even back then, 2,500 years ago.
So you won't be going back to Reardon snails for food anymore. It's mucin all the way.
What really does it for me, and this is what makes my heart grow and swell and gives me pride in what I'm doing, is when I'm walking down the street, possibly in Monaghan or anywhere around, and a mother or a father will come across, shake my hand and say, "Your products cured my son or my daughter," and I get such a kick out of that. It's worth more than anything in the world.
Thank you very much indeed, Terry. And can I just say, if you have any medical condition, any issue with your skin at all, we recommend that you go to see your GP in the first instance. OK, we're just bringing this story to you for what it's worth. But go and check with your GP. That's all we have time for today. My thanks to Terry Flanagan, Richard Collins and Niall Hatch. Don't forget to visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. We'll do it all again next week. Until then, goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. Bye.
Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney. And of course, you can listen back to all episodes in the series or share them with friends at the Mooney Goes Wild website or wherever you get your podcasts.
Email mooney@rte.ie.